Leave the spin doctors behind and enter the fray of the Culture Catch. Joining me today, impresario and hair producer Michael Butler. This is Dusty Wright for the Culture Catch. Michael, welcome to the Culture Catch.
Mark, it's a pleasure to be here.
You got to call me Dusty, remember?
Dusty.
We're branding.
Dusty.
You're not the first, you won't be the last.
Okay.
We're branding here. Michael, tell us a little bit about your upbringing. You don't have to go into great detail, but just, you know, you're a man of letters and all of that, and then making your way into the world of theater producer.
Well, I was come from a family that's been in this country since 1654. We were Irish, Anglo-Irish refugees from Cromwell, and came over at that time. Ultimately, we were papermakers and wound up in Chicago, area outside of Chicago. We were the largest landowners in DuPage County, which was the county next to Cook, and had a very successful business in paper, aviation, and other interests. Cattle and horse ranching was very important to the family in those days. It's a very interesting background. I was raised with our farm, which had 13 polo fields and could house 400 horses.
I know you have no love for polo.
And two packs of foxhounds. And I mean, it was just a life that is no longer possible. But it was an incredible childhood. I was raised by a highly conservative, right family, secular right, religious. Religion was really not a major thing to the rest of the family. And my father and I ultimately became a strong member of the military industrial establishment. I became a very close friend of Jack Kennedy's, personally and politically. I also did a lot of work for him in the Middle East. I warned him in 1958 when I was doing the bulk of my reports. He was a senator in those days. That the Palestinian question was the next world war.
So you come from this conservative background. Now you're working with one of the great democratic minds. How did your father react to that initially?
Well,
and they were a great family as well. So I'm
Well, it's very strange. Both families lived in Palm Beach, and one time I came home at 7 o'clock in the morning. And I was going up the steps of my grandmother's house, internal steps. She had one of those Meisner mansions. And my stepmother was coming down the steps. And she said, "Where have you been?" I said, "I've been to the Kennedys." Well, my grandmother's dressing room overlooked the steps. And out of the dressing room came this voice, this window voice saying, "You've been socially ruined," because the attitude about the WASPy part of the Palm Beach about the Kennedys is that they were the Pitts. And
they didn't have the lineage.
They didn't have the lineage. They were, you know, lace curtain Irish. They were mixed.
Right.
Yeah. And but anyway, I adored Jack. We got into a lot of problems together. And at one time, Jackie considered me a very bad influence on Jack. Later on, I think she realized that I was not the leader in that organization. When Jack was assassinated, well, first I should tell you, Jack wanted me to go into the White House. And he said, would you like to go back to the Middle East? And I said, no, I would like to run the BIA, the Bureau of Indian Affairs. And I'll never forget what he said. He said, what do you want to get into that snake pit for? And I said, I want to disband it. Well, right now you see a great legal case in the courts about what the BIA has done to the Indians. And they have claims of $176 billion that has been ripped off by the BIA for the Indians. Anyway, I didn't go to the White House because my father wanted me to stay at Oak Brook and said, if you will do this, there was a bit of a family feud going on in those days, if you will do this, why, I will pay your salary during Jack's second term. He can have you for $1 a year. Well, that was a lovely situation. Jack was killed. I, like most people who were involved, just dropped out. I had no interest in being involved. I was horrified. No interest in being politics. I knew we were at a watershed situation. And did nothing until Bobby called me. And Bobby, whom I'd never really been fond of, in fact, worse than that, I really disliked him. Bobby was a tough Mick.
And we're talking Bobby Kennedy, for the young viewers.
Yeah, and Bobby was, he was the pit bull for Jack. And I'll never forget one time we were all up in Sugar Bush skiing, and I overheard Bobby saying, well, what's Michael Butler done for us now? Well, shit, I'd given them about 5 or 6 planes out of Butler Aviation for the campaign. In fact, Norman Perlstein, who's the editor-in-chief of Time, sent me a photograph recently of Jack holding a newspaper, and it is in front of Butler Aviation in Washington. And it's the newspapers telling him that he's won the primary in West Virginia.
What a piece of work is man, how noble in reason, how infinite in faculties, in poor man moving, how express and admirable, in action, how
drop out. Bobby asked you, Bobby Kennedy asked you to join the fray.
Yeah, he asked me to get back into politics. Bobby had changed when Jack was assassinated. And I think Bobby, in fact, I'm absolutely positive that Bobby considered that he was responsible for Jack's assassination.
And this is one of your theories. We've discussed this before.
Yeah, I feel that it was mafia directed.
The assassination.
The assassination. I feel that, basically speaking, what had happened is that Joe, the father, had made a deal to get Jack elected, and the deal involved the mafia. And I feel that Bobby's and Jack's attack on the mafia was violating all the ground rules of that part of the world. It's a theory. It may not be right, but it seems to line up pretty correctly. And anyway,
so Oliver Stone wasn't too far off?
No, I think Oliver Stone was very much on. I feel that there's also a terrific book by a man called Richard Mahoney called Sons and Brothers about the Kennedys. Well worthwhile reading. Bobby became much more warm, much more of a humanist, so forth and so on. And he said, I would like to have you get involved to help Otto Kerner be reelected as the governor of Illinois. And I said, okay. So I went to work for Otto Kerner, who my father, even though Kerner was a Democrat, my father thought the world of. And a great number of Republicans thought the world of Otto Kerner. At the time that Bobby called me, the odds were 6-1 that Kerner would lose. His opponent was Chuck Percy. Chuck Percy was the head of Bell & Howell, which is one of the best companies in Illinois. Very bright guy, who subsequently, he and I became close friends. I took some bets, made some bets at that time, at 6-1 odds, that Kerner would win. Didn't bet an enormous amount, but enough to make it worthwhile. The interesting aspect about this whole campaign is that the manager of the campaign wound up being indicted for a conflict of interest by a Republican grand jury, naturally.
Go figure.
And so I had to step in to really help run the campaign, wound up having a very deep involvement with the campaign. I was made chairman of the Organization of Economic Development for the state. I ran the Illinois Sports Council, and I later on became the first chancellor of the Lincoln Academy, which is still very active in Illinois. We won. Otto was reelected. I adored this man, respected him enormously. He was much more of a conservative than I was, frankly, even in those days. But I decided, well, I was that deeply into politics, I'd run for the state Senate. So I became a candidate for the state Senate in DuPage County. DuPage County is right next to Cook County. Cook County is considered a fief of the Democratic Party and the Daley family in particular. But DuPage County makes Cook County look amateurish. The Republicans have an absolute lock. They've never elected anybody even to be dog catcher who was under the Democratic.
You love the challenge. Huh?
I love the challenge. And we had a terrific campaign. We all have the same problems was my thing. Of course, I was playing polo, doing all these other things, but still, the problems were the same.
You were easy pickings for the Republicans, huh?
Robert Peitzer ran the campaign. The campaign won several awards. I lost the election.
At what odds?
There was no bets on that. Oh, okay. I wouldn't bet on myself.
Well, how close was the election result?
Well, what was very interesting is that I got more votes than any Democrat in the history of the county.
What year was it?
This was the spring of 1967.
67.
That summer, I had a young gardener. I had two gardeners, an old man who was there all the time, and a young gardener I would get from a local college.
People don't have gardeners anymore, Michael.
Yeah.
Well, they maybe. But.
And so I had two gardens, actually. It was an upper garden and a lower garden. I discovered this kid was growing marijuana in the lower garden. I got into it with him. We spent the summer getting stoned. And he was...
A whole new world opened up.
A whole new world opened up. He was...
And how old were you at this stage?
Let's see, how old was I? I was in my late 20s, I think.
All right, so you have a gardener.
Yeah.
You get yourself into a little reefer.
Yes.
And was it good stuff?
It was not bad. It was not bad. Actually, it wasn't stuff out of the garden by that time. He was growing it. It's stuff that he brought from, you know, some other location, because we kept the plants growing while it was going on. So anyway, towards the end of the summer, we were into our own produce. But he was a pacifist, and he was going to be dragged off to war. And I got very emotionally involved with him, because I began to realize, while I had always been a military industrial hawk, that this war, which was not going to affect me personally, was a terrible thing to these kids. So I really began to, my whole thinking began to change. Now that was towards the end of the summer of 67. In September or early October, I forget exactly when, Otto Kerner was appointed chairman of the Civic Rights Commission, and later known as the Kerner Commission about Civil Rights. And his co-chair was John Lindsay, who was the mayor of New York. So Otto had to come here to New York, and he asked me to come with him. I was in many ways sort of an ADC to Otto. You know, if he needed a drink, I'd find it. And, I mean, I worship the guy. I'd do anything
for him. That's aide-de-camp for you people who don't know pseudonyms.
And so we came to New York for these meetings. And I belonged to the Racquet and Tennis Club. And I went into the bar one day, and I picked up a newspaper, New York Times. And I looked, and I saw in the theatrical section an ad for Hair, the American Tribal Love Rock Musical. First, the name Tribe struck me. And second, the photograph was of Indian braves. And I thought, my God, the Indians have got a show together. Well, this is very important if you remember what I said about the BIA. But even more so, the closest member of my family to myself was my grandfather, who told me also, who had a big ranch in South Dakota and 5 ranches in Montana, and was very heavily in the cattle and horse business. And my grandfather told me horror stories about the way the Indians were treated, and about them being shot for sport and things like that. And it just, he just was horrified.
Right.
The whole. So I had great interest in the Indian movement. So me, I thought, my God, the Indians had got the show together.
Right.
Well, I got tickets to the first preview. It was the opening show at Joe Papp's Anspacher Theater. Down at the Shakespeare Festival.
This is where the public now is.
Public, yeah. And it was the public, but he had he had just built the Anspacher, first show. I went down with Nancy Friday and Olivier Coquelin. Nancy was the author of My Secret Garden, My Mother, Myself, and had been, had
were
worked
you, were you
with
guys romantically inclined?
We were at one time very romantically inclined. In fact, she worked with me when I was a stint in the publishing world. And
That's another story.
Olivier Coquelin was my partner in discotheques in Hippopotamus, Ondine, Talisman, Ski Club 10. He was a chap that I met in Saint-Tropez and brought over where I first saw a discotheque, brought him over, and we started the first discotheques that were built in this country. They were very successful. So the three of us went down under assistance, various substances and so forth and so on, and saw the first preview of Hair. What I discovered was not so much an Indian show, but I discovered the most anti-war statement I had ever seen. And I thought, my God, this would be perfect to take for my constituents in Illinois. So I called Roger. I said, can you get me a meeting with Joe Papp? And he said, sure. So he did that. So I had a proper introduction. Because Pap was a bit of an awesome character in New York in those days and was considered very strong and so forth. Went, met him and talked to him and said, no, we're not interested in show going to Chicago. We run a show for 4 to 6 weeks. It's history and we go on and do something else. Oh, I was very disappointed. I left, went back to...
That's a bit of history I wasn't familiar with, that they would dismantle the shows even though they might have the potential to be imported elsewhere,
exactly.
Or exported elsewhere, I should say.
Well, at that time, later on, they changed their,
of course,
their program. And so he was not interested. So I went back to Oak Brook. About 10 days later, the phone rang, and it was Joe Papp. And he said, would you like to be the co-producer with us of the show? We've been very well reviewed. So I said immediately, yes.
What was it, was the show, did the show just blow your mind when you sing it that night?
Yeah, it did. It blew my mind mainly because of its social and political aspects. I came to New York, went to work with this co-production between the Shakespeare Festival and myself. And we made a deal with Olivier. Olivier had built another discotheque, not with me, but with Borden Stevenson, Adlai's son, called the Cheetah on Broadway. So we made a deal to run Hair at the Cheetah.
In those days, that was one of the hottest clubs.
Yeah,
if not the hottest club in New York.
But it didn't work at the Cheetah. At the same time, I discovered that the relationship between a not-for-profit and a for-profit operation was very difficult to bridge, and still is to this day. So we parted company. On a very friendly basis. Joe had not picked up the first-class rights. He really didn't believe that much in the future of the show. I did, but I made a deal to give the Shakespeare Festival royalties. So the public got royalties from us for years.
That's the public theater, not the public at large.
Large, yeah. Public theater got the royalties, which really kept them alive for a long time. And Joe and I wound up being rather close friends. He even spent a Christmas at my home in England and with his family and so forth and so on. However,
that was a life lesson for him, or a business lesson, letting things go too early.
Yeah, because later on, with Chorus Line, they tied into the first thing. But I think they also realized, however, that their modus operandi was not good. So when it went to a commercial side, commercial producers took over. The next thing that happened is that the authors were not happy with the direction of Hair at the public. They had wanted all along a man called Tom O'Horgan to be a director.
What was Tom doing in the...
Tom was basically at La Mama, doing a lot of very unusual work, La Mama. And at the time that they did Hair originally, he had another commitment. Or he probably would have been the director at the public. And it doesn't mean that the people who directed the public performance of Hair were not good. They were good. But it was too serious. It was cool for a small, non-Broadway, off-Broadway type of audience, 200-seaters who were into serious theater. But it was not good for from the general public's viewpoint.
What was the most radical play on Broadway prior to Hair? Was there anything that was pushing and defining the counterculture?
No. No.
So it was an enormous gamble. People have to realize it was an enormous gamble.
Enormous gamble, and it was also very, it was shocking to most people.
Pap ends up letting you take the rights over on the show.
Right.
You're at the Cheetah, and the Cheetah's not really working. The space has limitations. It's not the right venue. You really need to get it into a proper Broadway house.
Right. And also we changed the director. Brought in Tom O'Horgan. That was mainly due to the influence of my executive producer, a wild Corsican called Bertrand Castelli.
And he a lot of glee.
Yeah, he was a terrific guy and really knew the theater. And he was the one who really convinced me about Tom O'Horgan, because I'm usually very much against change, and of course I was dealing with something that I loved to begin with, so I didn't want to change it. Anyway, we brought Tom in, and it was incredible what he did. And the main thing that Tom brought to it was the building of a feeling that the tribe really was a tribe. And we stopped calling them castes. I started to call them tribes. And his whole principle of sensitivity exercises was to build trust between each one of the members of the tribe. And he was very successful. And I even convinced him to bring the backstage and offstage people and people who were working with us into these exercises. So it created a wonderful feeling between not only those who were on stage, but other people who were involved in the show, directly and indirectly.
So nobody felt like they were just one small cog.
No.
You all felt like you were integral to the success.
Exactly. And we were. I mean, I don't care what anybody says, collaboration is the key to live theater. And this was an incredible collaboration and was created only by the work of the most minor member of the so-called hierarchy of the situation.
Do you think we're missing a lot of that in today's theater?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Number one, today's theater is not controlled by the artistic community anymore. It's controlled by the bean counters. One of the great tragedies in this country has been the monopolization of the media. Now you have media being controlling so much and in so few hands that in the case of the present government, why you see that they are able to control the media because the media wants things from them. And they only have to deal with a few people. Thank God for the internet. Also, you have too many suits running the theatrical world. Broadway has become so expensive that the independent producers are practically non-existent. I'll give you an example. To do a tour of Hair, I'm talking about a first-class tour, would cost $3 million.
And that would be for how long?
To mount it.
Just to mount it. But from city to city, how many week run?
Well, they might run for a month in each city or something like that, but I mean, that's, you don't need, beyond that, you're hopefully in profit, so you're paying back the investment.
But just to get it up and going into rehearsals?
Into rehearsal, to open it, $3 million. To do it on Broadway, 12. It's become frighteningly expensive. Unless you're Disney, you don't really belong on Broadway anymore.
And that's why they let things that have critically been hammered to stay on Broadway, because they have to try to recoup the public. That's the case with Wicked. The critics weren't particularly kind to Wicked, but the public liked it. Yeah. And they wrote it out.
Right. And, of course, they had a tremendous amount of money behind Wicked, so they were able to stand it.
Weather that.
So you've got your independent artistic producers are being driven out of the business. And the big corporations are taking over. What we're doing, the independents, is that we're dealing with Off-Broadway, or in the case of Pope Joan, I plan to do London. In the case of Dracula, I want to do it in Bucharest. if the Romanians ever can keep a government in place long enough, why, we'll do it in Bucharest. But it's the same thing in the film industry. Film industry's been taken
and music.
And music. I mean, my God, the music industry. They've all been taken over, so you've got four or five companies that dominate media. They dominate the culture of this country.
They just keep buying catalog and acquiring like giant snowballs.
Right. And also the bad thing about it is that you've got a small group of men who are making decisions that affect an entire culture of a country and affect the livelihood of almost all the artists in the country. I mean, there are very few things. The most independent thing today is live theater. And the most interesting place I find is Los Angeles. And because Los Angeles has got more storefront theaters, 99 seats or less, than any place in the country.
Affordable housing.
Affordable housing, right.
You can't do it in New York anymore. No. They've priced out the artist in
right.
New York.
And the other thing is that because of television and film, you have a tremendous pool of artists in LA who desperately want to be on the board, so to speak, to do their craft.
Right.
So they'll go into one of these small theaters for next to nothing, and under the condition that if they get a paying gig, they can step out.
That's great.
Yeah, and it works very well. I belong to one of the theater companies. I go frequently to another one, and I'm on the board of a third. So I work heavily with this type of operation.
Right. Why do you think Joe Public is so reluctant to embrace the independent spirit? Because children today are force-fed the marketing twists and shapings of what they think is good taste in literature and art and film and theater.
Absolutely.
And the internet obviously offers the antidote to all of that.
Absolutely, and that's why the internet's going to become more and more powerful as time goes on.
And I think they're already trying to get their hands into the internet, the government.
They are, and I don't think they're going to succeed. We don't think they're going to succeed.
We hope not, but you know, there are strongholds. It's interesting just in podcasting how quickly the major corporations jumped on the podcasting wagon for their positioning on iTunes and some of the other web browser podcasting sites to try to position themselves. Yet the independent spirit manages to break through, and there are shows that do get into the top 10 and the top 20. But you see every day you check iTunes, look at the majority of the shows.
Yeah, well, the big thing, as long as money is not involved, it's going to succeed.
It's tough. It's tough to do, but the indie spirit remains.
Yeah.
Where do you see your material, where do you see the hair, the tribe mentality moving as the years click off here and the technology becomes more and more available for the lower class, lower middle class?
Well, I think that my involvement with hair has become more with the tribes than it is with the show. And I find that the tribes are a tremendous platform for discourse. And most of them are of, I don't want to say a liberal persuasion. They're close to liberal. I happen to be a libertarian. I'm socially a liberal and I'm financially a conservative. Of course, the present government in this country is opposed to both. They say it's libertarian. Bullshit, it's not libertarian. It's totally opposed to the libertarian philosophy. We've got the worst financial scene we've had in my lifetime. Culturally, socially, it's a disaster what's going on. I think that the future for the hair tribes is for us to continue the message that was in hair, which is still appropriate today.
What is your fondest memory of hair? Is there one memory that sticks out in your mind that just says, that defines what it was and what it represented to a generation and what it continues to represent for the oppressed?
It's very difficult to say. I would think that my fondest memory of Hare are the people that I've gotten to know well within Hare. Jibrayeff being one. There have been several others that I had dinner with Keith Carradine a couple of nights ago. Michael Walter Harris or Nina Dayton. All the whole, I mean, I can go on and on and on. A whole bunch of people that I really have loved being involved with and enjoyed. As far as actual incidents, I would think the opening night here in New York was such a stunning happening. It just blew everybody's mind. And we realized that we had a big hit on our hands, which we never really expected or thought. No, we never really thought. I mean, my belief in Hare was totally from a social political point of view. I didn't
the
know.
The critics just completely.
Well, one critic was the power that made Hare.
Really? Who was that?
Clive Barnes, fellow with the New York Times. Right. And still to this day, the New York Times dominates the theater.
Right.
If they like a show, it's got a chance.
Right.
It's amazing because Hare has probably been seen by more people worldwide than any musical in history. It's still going on.
Right.
Constantly.
Some amazing stories. And, we could go on for hours.
Dusty, thanks a lot. I've enjoyed every minute of it.
Thank you, Michael. And we look forward to more Michael Butler in the near future.
Cool.
Thanks.
She asked me why I'm just a hairy guy. I'm hairy noon and night. Hair, that's a fright. I'm hairy high and low. Don't ask me why. Don't know. It's not for lack of bread, like the grateful dead. Darling,
give me that head with hair, long, beautiful hair, shining, gleaming, steaming, flashing, waxing. Give me down to there, hair, shoulder length, longer. Here, baby, there, mama, everywhere, daddy, daddy, hair. Blow it, show it, long as God can do it. My hair, let it fly in the breeze and get caught in the trees. Give a home to the fleas in my hair. A home for fleas, a hive for the buzzing bees, a nest for birds, there ain't no words for the beauty, the splendor, the wonder of my hair. Blow it, show it, long as God can grow it, my hair. I want it long, straight, curly, fuzzy, snaggy, shaggy, ratty, matty, oily, greasy, fleecy, shiny, gleaming, steaming, waxy, wax. Made of blonde, brilliant, team, biblical hair. My hair like Jesus wore it. Hallelujah, I adore it. Hallelujah, Mary loved the sun. Why don't my mother love me? Hair, blow it, show it, long as God can grow it. My hair, blow it, show it, long as God can grow it.
You've been listening to my interview with Michael Butler. I'd like to thank today's sponsors, Final Draft, the industry standard scriptwriting software. Check them out at www.finaldraft.com. And our new sponsor, WebHSP. For all of your web hosting needs, it's webhsp.com. This is Dusty Wright for the Culture Catch. We'll see you next time. Converge is the word.